It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look at some of the coolest science news with Discover Magazine's Gemma Tarlak, including the latest effort to create a probe that can withstand the hostile surface of planet Venus.
First, on Friday, the U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions asked for the resignations of 46 federal prosecutors appointed by former President Obama. According to the Federal Department of Justice, many of the U.S. attorneys nominated by Obama had already resigned. Previous administrations have also asked for similar resignations during times of transition.
But Preet Bharara, U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, refused to resign, so he was fired. This move was unexpected because President Trump had reportedly met with Bharara in November privately and suggested the attorney might continue in that role. Some senior Democrats have suggested Bharara was fired to stop him from investigating President Trump's financial affairs.
Frank Turkheimer joins us now. He's a professor emeritus of law at UW-Madison. He was U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Wisconsin from 1977 to 1981. He was an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of New York and an associate special Watergate prosecutor. Frank, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
Was the sudden removal of these federal attorneys what you would call out of the ordinary, or was this business as usual for new administrations?
Well, if you take away your adjective, sudden, it's normal. It is normal for there to be changes in U.S. attorneys when there are changes in the presidency, especially when there's a change in party. But you stick in the adjective sudden, and it is highly abnormal and actually not very much in the interest of the United States and its representation by U.S. attorneys' offices. I'm not aware of any such mass firings that are instantaneous as these are.
You call them firings, not resignations.
Well, it's just a matter of form. Like Bharara was asked to resign. He didn't resign, so he was fired. I mean, the statute says that U.S. attorneys serve it, and I think this is a quote, at the pleasure of the president. Well, that means, you know, if you're asked to resign and you don't resign, you can be fired. And that's what happened in the Bharara sequence.
Why would you say this sort of sudden, the adjective we use there, because it was sudden on Friday, why was this, as you said, not in the interest in the judicial functioning of the United States?
Look, I mean, the U.S. attorney, he doesn't sit around twiddling his or her thumbs. They have a job to do, and there are undoubtedly things that they're working on several cases, and by definition almost they're going to be important cases because the U.S. attorney is going to be handling the really important stuff in the office. And there are things to be done. And to just say you're out, I mean, the transition is not smooth. I mean, there are things that, you know, the U.S. attorney knows. I mean, he's got to be able to sit down and talk with people, explain, this is, here are the options, these are the choices I'm facing, these are the understandings I have with lawyers who are as part of this investigation. There's so much stuff that goes on that is in the U.S. attorney's head that has to be transferred, and to just say you're out is, it just doesn't work for a smooth transition. You know, in Wisconsin, I think, knowing John Vaudrey, I suspect he's got a couple of cases that he's supposed to try in the next month or two, which he obviously won't be able to. And there's just no question that it's best in the interest of the United States that John try those cases rather than someone who's not as familiar with them as he is. And that's why a sudden removal is really not in the furtherance of effective representation of the United States.
You're a formal federal prosecutor. What was your experience like during presidential transitions?
You know, it seems like light years ago when it was announced that I would be appointed by President Carter. I gave a call to the incumbent, Dave Mebbin, who I think was a Ford appointee. I don't think he was Nixon. I think he was Ford. And, you know, we talked about a date which would be a smooth transition date that would let him clean up stuff that he was working on, also let me finish what I was doing. I think I was teaching at the time, so it was convenient to go to the end of the semester. I think the conversation took place in April, and we agreed upon an early June date. And it couldn't have gone more smoothly. When President Reagan was elected in 1980, I knew that my tenure as U.S. attorney was going to come to an end. And I had an understanding with John Byrne, who was my successor, that, you know, the moment he was confirmed by the Senate and appointed, I would resign. And that was some date, I think, in July or August of 1981. It let me finish up what I was doing. There was just one matter that was still open. It's ancient history now. I brought a prosecution against Alex Ranieri, who was the circuit judge in Iron County. And it was a major corruption prosecution. And I think it was working on the appellate brief. And we all decided it would be best in the interest of the United States if I argued that rather than have somebody, this case had about 60 witnesses, have somebody who didn't know anything about the case represent the government. So John and I worked out that I'd be a special assistant for a couple of weeks and argue the case before the Seventh Circuit, which I did, and ultimately it was affirmed. I mean, that's the way things should be. And I think that's my experience is that's the way they were. And when I attended U.S. attorneys conferences, I found that my experience was typical. There was no none of this, you're fired, like, get out of here, you're done as of tonight. That's just not the way it was done.
We're talking with Frank Terheimer right now, professor emeritus of law at UW-Madison. He was a U.S. attorney for the Western District of Wisconsin from 1977 to 1981. And you mentioned John Vaudry, and you appointed that attorney. Do you know anything about where he might be in his caseloads or what his circumstances are from here in Wisconsin?
Well, John has tried a lot of cases. You're right, I appointed him as an assistant, I think it was in 1980. John tries a lot of cases, and they're important. Obviously, all cases are important. And knowing him, I suspect he's got some cases that he's got to try, which have to be transferred now. What kind of investigations he's working on, I don't know, but I suspect he has been. And I think John has resigned effective the end of this week or something like that. That's about as tight as you can make it, but it's really not helpful for the effective representation of the United States.
Now, the highest profile example of this turnover seems to be attorney Preet Bharara from the Southern District of New York, and that one has a little bit more of a backstory to it. We have seen reports that President Trump met with attorney Bharara, asked him to stay on, and there was some sort of maybe informal agreement there that he would stay on, and then he was asked to resign, refused as the reporting goes, and was fired. What do you think about that story?
Well, I do remember back in November after the election, but obviously before the inauguration, there was that meeting, and the president did make that commitment to Bharara, which is not, it doesn't have the force of law. When the statute says at the pleasure of the United States, at the pleasure of the president, I mean, it obviously contemplates that the president can tell him in November, I want you to stay, and tell him in February, I want you to go, or in March. It's a little disturbing because the Southern District of New York, where Bharara is U.S. attorney or was U.S. attorney, where I've worked as an assistant, has a long tradition of independence from the Justice Department and from the political scene in general. I mean, I suspect that the politics of the people in that office is all over the place. It always has been, at least historically, since at least for 50, 60 years. And it's a little bit in derogation of that for the president just to say you're out. I mean, the standing that the Southern District has as an independent, nonpartisan place should set it apart a little bit from most other offices. I mean, not like as if the Western District of Wisconsin was a political place. But there's a long history and tradition of independence there, which certainly runs against this. Even when Richard Nixon wanted Bob Morgenthau gone, he gave him, I think, almost a full year. I think Morgenthau ended up resigning in December of 69, more than a year after the election, because there was stuff he was working on that he wanted to finish, and it was recognized that it's in the interest of the government of the United States that these matters be completed as effectively as possible, and that's certainly not going to happen in the Southern District now with Bharara going, and I suspect that's why he refused to quit, because his obligation, as he sees it, is to the United States government, and he didn't feel that quitting was in the interest of the United States, so he was fired.
Now, as we wrap up, some senior Democrats have said that they find the timing of this firing suspicious, Elizabeth Warren among them. On Wednesday, several watchdog organizations sent Attorney Barrera a letter asking him to look into whether or not President Trump had violated the Constitution's Emoluments Clause. What do you think of the timing?
Well, you know, first of all, I got to say, whether there's a violation of the Emoluments Clause is not a criminal matter. I mean, it might be a violation of the Constitution, but it's not a crime. So I never understood why that should be the subject of a criminal investigation. It's the Constitution says you can't accept it, but crimes are made defined by the legislature. I mean, like, what's the punishment? There's no. It's not a crime. So I don't that stuff. I don't get that. Whether Barrera was working on other things, that my guess is that the tradition of independence in that office is so strong that even if a political hack were to be appointed as U.S. attorney, which may not happen, you just can't kill it. You can't if there's an ongoing investigation which potentially might be embarrassing to the administration, it would be very difficult to kill that. I mean, I can't see that happening.
Frank, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure, anytime.
That was Frank Terheimer, Professor Emeritus of Law at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about President Trump's administration asking 46 top federal prosecutors to resign.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk about the rise of addictive technology from our phones to our TVs and everything in between.
Right now, NASA wants to send a probe to the planet Venus, but the 800-degree Fahrenheit temperatures and sulfuric acid clouds make things a bit tricky. So scientists are working on a probe that uses some old-school technology, so old that Leonardo da Vinci might be familiar with it.
Gemma Tarlak joins us now to share the details of that story and more. She's a senior editor for Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, and she joins us once a month to talk about science news. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, it's great to be with you again.
So why is it so tricky to send a probe to Venus?
Well, Venus is not a place a probe would want to go. It is super good at frying circuits. I think the longest record for any machine surviving there is actually about 2 hours. It's got the temperatures that you mentioned. It's got that sulfuric acid. It's kind of a perfect storm of a place that you don't want a super high-tech instrument to be.
And what are we trying to find out by getting a probe down to the surface of Venus? What unanswered questions are we trying to get answers for?
Well, there's always knowledge for the sake of knowledge, you know. That's a great thing. But also, Venus is, in a lot of ways, kind of our twin. And we think, for example, that it's seismically active, but we really haven't been able to get good information on that because, again, we haven't been able to send a probe down that lasts for any reasonable amount of time.
So it sounds like there is a bit of a blast from the past in terms of the technology that's used because of the particulars of the climate at Venus that we're talking about there. So what kind of thing will work there to get information?
Well, and I have to say, this is not actually set in stone happening yet, but the engineers at NASA came up with this terrific rover. It's called the Automaton Rover for Extreme Environments, and it's built entirely of hardened metal, and it's guided by a clockwork computer. And this is, you know, this is way, way, way back in the day. We're talking about, for example, there's a 2,000-year-old Greek clockwork computer that was used to determine eclipses, to predict eclipses. Well, it's kind of like that. It's something that, you know, Leonardo da Vinci would have been familiar with, but it is all super old school. And they came up with this project to send this rover to Venus and then actually have the data it collects engraved on a phonograph-like record. I love this, right? Keep holding on to your vinyl, folks. It might come in useful for science. But basically, this phonographic record would have all the data recorded onto it, and then balloons would launch from the rover up just high enough so that there's a drone that's safely flying above, and the drone would pick up the phonographic records from the balloon. This is so steampunk. I love it.
I was going to say, is this a steampunk movie script?
The drone would relay the records up to a spacecraft that would be orbiting Venus. And from there, the spacecraft would process the data and send it back to Earth. So it's like a multi-step procedure. But again, you know, it's not involving any of the super high-tech stuff that, say, the Mars Curiosity rover has.
This is all if it's not intercepted by the evil Dr. Morbando and his clockwork robots, right?
I know. It's such a wonderful, like, Jules Verne discovery story.
It doesn't sound very precise. I mean, I know it's NASA, but you're talking about balloons and sending up photographs, but this is precise enough that this drone can capture the information?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, when you think about it, actually landing the Mars rover involved a balloon, and that they worked that down to just, you know, the nanosecond in terms of timing. So if I was going to give anyone a job, a scientific job involving a balloon, I would give it to NASA because they know what they're doing.
And I know you said this is a design idea, more or less. Now, is there an idea of when it could be made and sent to Venus?
Well, they're still talking about it. So it's, you know, not going to take that long to make. No, I'm kidding. It is a pretty involved thing. But, you know, it's one of those things that they're thinking of doing. And now that they have a plan that might actually work, it's definitely on the drawing board as something they want to make happen.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak right now from Discover Magazine, catching up on the latest in science news. And Gemma, another topic we're going to take a look at now is warfare and the idea of where did it come from and how finely attuned are humans or inclined are humans to warfare. What's at stake there?
Yeah, well, you know, pretty much there are two main camps that have been argued. You could say they've been at war over warfare for a long time. Different camps of anthropologists and archaeologists. One says basically violence against each other is innate. We are hardwired for it. And the other camp says, you know, until humans started settling and building societies, building city-states, there was really no need for warfare. So warfare really grew out of the advent of agriculture and settling into city-states. And these, you know, two camps have been kind of arguing back and forth, but increasingly we're finding in the archaeological record just evidence that there were some really brutal massacres that may indicate some scale of warfare going back 10,000 years, well before agriculure really took hold.
10,000 years. Talk about some of the sites that people are looking at to find this evidence of horrific human warfare.
Sure. Well, the oldest one is a place called Nataruk, and it's in Kenya. And 10,000 years ago, it was actually the edge of this lagoon near Lake Turkana. And they found at least 27 people, men, women, children. They found remains of them, and they actually found 12 complete skeletons that were found face down in what had been the lagoon. And all of these bodies, everyone killed, just had horrific injuries that really could only be inflicted by, say, you know, blunt trauma or being shot with an arrow. This was not a case of, you know, animals getting hold of the people. They were definitely killed by other humans. And they found that, you know, the arrowheads were made out of obsidian, which is pretty rare in the area. So they think that it might have been the people coming in brought, you know, their obsidian arrowheads, and they may have been coming in from outside in a raid or maybe a territory takeover. So now you look at the oldest site, but there are a number of sites in Europe, specifically in what's now Germany, that, you know, for example, 3,000 years ago, there was a massive Bronze Age battle. They think it involved up to 2,000 people. And this was at a time before agriculture in this particular area really took hold. So it's, you know, a tantalizing question. Just what does this say about when warfare arose in our species?
And what about primatology? What can that tell us about whether we're geared in that direction?
Yeah, well, you know, Richard Wrangham, he is a famous primatologist, and he kind of leans toward the violence is hardwired for humans, and he points to chimps, which are our nearest living relatives. And, you know, chimps, they kind of avoid each other in terms of they avoid another pack, whatever, but if the alpha male within that chimp family senses that there's an opportunity, that maybe the other pack is weakened by, you know, maybe they don't have an alpha male, whatever, they will initiate a type of warfare. So we see it in primates. There was another study out last year where they tracked, you know, the number of interspecies or against your own species acts of violence, and they found that primates tend to be a very violent lineage. So there are all these signs. It's kind of, six of one, half dozen of another right now in terms of evidence about, is it hardwired in us to be violent and warring, or are we just, you know, generally peaceful, but in certain circumstances, we will turn to violence.
We'll keep watching that. And Gemma, I want to wrap up. I know we've got snow in Wisconsin today, but let's talk about rain. You wrote about that rainy season coming up, and we had some freakish winter rain not that long ago, and you shared some fun facts about rain. What were some of the fun things you learned?
Well, I think my favorite is the saying, raining cats and dogs. You know, I think we think of that as kind of a modern thing, but it actually shows up in the English language in the mid-17th century, and they think it may be a corruption of an old English word for waterfall called catadupe. And I guess if you say catadupe fast, it sounds kind of like cats and dogs. And they think that may be where it came from. Another fact I absolutely love, Earth is not the only place where it rains. Saturn's moon Titan has rain made of methane. That's no fun. And they think Saturn and Jupiter both have a type of helium rain, which I don't know, no word on if it makes your voice sound funny. But, it's, you know, certainly you want a very good umbrella on any of those planets or moons.
Is it true that the methane rain stays mainly on the plane?
I think so.
And Gemma, real quick as we wrap up, you also wrote about one of my favorite words, petrichor, and the science behind that. That's the smell that comes up kind of from the ground or the pavement after it rains.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it was just recently that they found that the smell called petrichor is actually the result of geosmin, all these great words to play Scrabble with, right? And that's a byproduct of soil bacteria. And actually, the average raindrop hits the surface with enough force to trap air bubbles right where it hits, and then the bubbles then rise and pop, and that releases aerosols, including geosmin.
Huh. All right, we'll look forward to that smell when it warms up a little. Gemma, thanks a lot for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to share some of the coolest science news.
Coming up after the news, can we be addicted to our technology? We'll look at that question and why it can be so hard to put down the phone or the remote control. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we talk with a government watchdog about how easy it is for the media and the public to access open records in Wisconsin.
First, these days, it seems like we can't stop clicking, tweeting, scrolling, binge-watching, and staring at screens. Technology is everywhere, and while it's hard to argue that it has an improved life for many of us, there can be a darker side to it when the infatuation blurs into addiction.
Our next guest says we're living through a digital age that's far more conducive to addiction than any other period in human history, and we're getting hooked. It's not totally our fault, though, he says. Developers are doing their best to make these services and products impossible to resist.
Adam Alter joins us now. He's an associate professor of marketing and psychology at New York University's Stern School of Business. His new book is Irresistible: The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, Adam, I think a lot of us get the sense that we are on our phones and other devices too much, but addiction. Can we really be addicted to technology?
Yeah, it's a very strong word, but it's a word that I think is appropriate here. You know, historically we thought addiction was reserved for experiences that involved ingesting substances. So we thought about drug addiction and alcohol abuse and nicotine addiction. But it turns out there's a lot of overlap between the experiences we engage in today, these behaviors, and those substances. So they excite the same brain processes. They lead to a very similar pattern of responses in the brain. If you look at teens as they watch the number of likes increase on their Instagram posts, for example, their brains look very much like the brains of addicts to substances. We also know that the addictions that people have to these devices and this tendency to just return to them over and over again is driven by the same sorts of psychological needs. So it deals with the same issues of loneliness for some people, boredom for others. So there's a lot of overlap, and a lot of the same definitions are satisfied, which suggests that this is actually a genuine form of addiction.
How do we know when we or when a person goes across the line between being what we want to call a healthy user of technology and into this compulsive, addictive territory?
Well, for something to be addictive, it has to be not only something that you enjoy doing that you keep returning to, but it has to have long-term harmful consequences for your well-being in at least one way. So, you know, very early on, some psychiatrists suggested that we were addicted to breathing, which is silly because obviously breathing is very good for us. If we stop breathing, that's obviously going to lead to bad outcomes. But if you use tech a lot and you feel that there is an obvious way in which it's disrupting your life, say it's making it hard for you to form strong relationships with loved ones, with kids, with significant others, it's affecting your friendships, it's costing you a lot of money, it's leading you to sit on the couch for long periods when you'd rather be exercising, things like that, that's how you know you're addicted.
And as I read your book, you're not anti-technology or anti any device in particular. It's more how it fits into the landscape of our lives.
That's exactly right. I'm a big user of tech. My family lives a very long way away, and the way that I can introduce them to my young son and have a sense that I'm still nearby, even though I'm such a long way away, is through the miracle of tech. So I'm a huge tech user and a huge tech fan. I think what we need to do, though, is to recognize how insidious tech can be. It can really invade areas of our lives where we really should probably exclude it. And the trick is to have what we have with the environment, which is a sort of sustainable relationship with tech, so that it does the good things and doesn't do too many of the bad things to our lives.
Talking to Adam Alter about our addiction to technology. His book is Irresistible, The Rise of Addicted Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. And Adam, let's get into that business of keeping us hooked. There are a lot of people out there who want us to use their app or their device or watch their program or things like that. What kind of tools are they using to get us to keep coming back?
Well, they're pretty sophisticated. So a lot of them are employing behavioral experts and statisticians. And what they'll do is they'll crunch a lot of numbers and they'll get a sense of which elements of their products are hard for us to resist and which elements we can leave and do without. So one thing game designers will do, for example, is they'll release multiple versions of a particular game or a mission on the game. And they'll see which ones are attracting people for longer periods of time. Then they'll take the missions or the versions that just don't do quite as well, they'll cast them aside, and then they'll create new versions, multiple versions of the version that seemed of the mission that was appealing to people. And they'll keep iterating that process. So what you have is this sort of evolution where 20 generations later, you've got this maximally addictive kind of weaponized version of the original mission that people find very, very hard to do without.
And you see parallels, especially to the world of gambling addiction and gambling technology with the uncertain reward and the happy lights and the potential, not the guarantee, but the potential of a payoff.
Yeah, it's funny. This is a strange truth about humans and, in fact, all animals really, is that we love certainty, but even more, we love the uncertain promise of good rewards. That's why gambling is so appealing to us and why we spend a lot of money on lotteries and things that have this promise, this very slim promise of a good outcome, even if there's a pretty good chance of no positive outcome at all. And a lot of social media works that way. When you release content into the world, there's a fair chance you're not going to receive the response you're looking for. But for those few times when you get the positive feedback that you are looking for, that's so appealing to us that we end up going back for more. And we will check time and time again when we post something. We'll check our friend counts, for example, as well to see if they're climbing. And that really keeps us on the hook. We are fascinated by the outcomes.
I will admit to this. I'm not a huge poster on any kind of social media. I can get sucked in and look at what other people are. But when I do twice a year post something on Facebook or whatever, I'll keep looking at why aren't people liking it and things like that. This is really something that our brains are looking for a reward for doing.
It really is. And even if you aren't a big poster, there's a bottomlessness to the content online now. So a lot of these platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and so on, they didn't start as bottomless platforms. They had a sort of limit. You'd have to click a button to continue. You can scroll down on these now, and there's so much information available that there is no point at which your brain gets the signal to stop. And so you end up in this kind of well where you go deeper and deeper and deeper. You keep looking, and eventually it's 3 hours have passed.
We'll get back into some of the tactics there and some solutions, but I want to talk about what's the harm. I mean, we might say, okay, yeah, I get sucked in. I waste time here and there. I'm on an hour or two a day, or maybe more, you found out, than we think we are. What is the damage that it does to us, though?
I think the biggest damage is social. So there are some very interesting studies looking at this. One of them put two strangers in a room across from each other, and for some of the pairs of strangers that were looking at each other and having a conversation, there was a book nearby on the table. For the other strangers, there was a phone upside down, a smartphone. And these strangers had a conversation for a few minutes, and at the end of that conversation, the experimenter asked them questions like, how did you feel you developed a good connection there? Do you feel closer to this person? Did you disclose a lot of revealing information that brought you closer? Things like that. And when there was a phone in the room, the quality of that relationship was diminished. It basically wasn't as strong because phones pull us out of the here and now. And that's just one experiment, but there's a lot of research showing in kids, for example, that spending a lot of time on screens means that they never really acquire the skills that a lot of us have in navigating real-world social situations. The nuances that we pick up in emotions, for example, are just not available to these kids. And there's a whole generation now that's spending a lot of time in front of screens. I'm not an alarmist. I'm not saying that it'll be a disaster, but I certainly think it's something we need to think about pretty carefully. And there's a chance that these kids will look different from generations that came before.
Now, you mentioned this. When writing was invented, people thought, oh, this is taking away from our personal connections. Novels, same reaction, the printing press, you name it. Mm-hmm. Is this something fundamentally different?
I think so. I think the rate of acceleration in how advanced tech is today is unprecedented. And I think our evolution as a species just can't keep up and hasn't kept up with that rate of change. So television, for example, is fairly static. It arrived, it brought us pictures and sounds, and that was that. But if you look even in the last 13 years, Facebook was introduced in 2004. If you talk to teens today, they consider Facebook a relic that their parents and grandparents use. In 10 years, we will look back at Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, probably the same way. And we'll all be using the virtual reality goggles that industry is promising we'll all be using in 5 years, the same way we use smartphones. So I think, you know, we'll be faced with this choice. Do you want to spend time in the complex, imperfect real world, or would you like to spend time in this perfect virtual world? And it's going to be harder and harder and harder over time as these platforms become more sophisticated to say, you know what, I don't mind that the real world isn't perfect. I still want to stay here and have real conversations.
And you mentioned time, and you talk about in your book, and ironically, an app that tracks the amount of time people spend looking at their phones. What did you learn about yourself? What do people learn about themselves when they use this app?
It was staggering to me, actually. I spoke to the designer of the app. It's called Moment, M-O-M-E-N-T, and the guy who designed the app said that he asked a whole lot of friends when he first put it together to estimate how long they spent on their phones, and all of them massively underestimated their usage. They said things like an hour, when in fact it was on average two or three. He asked me what I thought my usage was like when he sent the link to me, and I said, I'm going to guess an hour a day. I was using it for between 3 and 4 hours a day.
And a lot of people probably would have exactly the same experience.
The average is 3 hours, just under 3 hours. It's incredible. And I give this to my students. I tell them at the beginning of class to use the app. And especially the younger students, some of them use it, their phones 8 to 10 hours a day.
We're talking right now with Adam Alter, author of the new book, Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. He says we're living through a digital age that's far more conducive to addiction than any period in human history, and technology companies and developers are taking advantage of that.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with our guest premise that we're addicted to technology? Have you yourself struggled with an addiction to email, social media, maybe a video game? And if so, how has it impacted your life? What, if anything, have you done about it? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking right now about the rise of addictive technology with Adam Alter, the author of Irresistible.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you gotten hooked on a screen of choice, a phone, a computer, a tablet, the TV, Netflix? What keeps you coming back to it? Did you reach a point where you thought, hey, I need to cut back, step away? Call in at 800-642-1234. And if you have kids, How do you handle the kids and screens conundrum? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Kim is with us in Eagle River. Kim, hi.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to share my story because I think I'm a little unique. I'm a millennial, and I don't have a social media account, and I don't have a smartphone. And, you know, I had Facebook for a while. It was becoming a problem with my marriage, so I just said, fine, I'm not going to do it. And it's tough not to. There's the conveniences that I really wish I had and the connections I really wish I could maintain, but just the more and more that comes out, I'm really glad I don't, and I know I would get sucked in. So I think part of it is just keeping it away from me.
If I can ask, Kim, you said a problem in your marriage just because of the amount of time on Facebook?
Yeah, well, and I don't, I mean, maybe I was underestimating, probably, as your guest said, but just like, you know, you're on it, I want to talk to you, you know, just getting in the way of communicating during those downtimes. We have young kids, and you don't get that very much, and so it just eats up a lot of time when you don't think it does.
Kim, thanks a lot for that call. Adam, do you see this reaction in other people, maybe other millennials like Kim? They've reached a point where they got to cut back radically, as Kim did.
Yeah, I do see this in a lot of people, and it's very rare to hear people that actually manage to do it. I think you're really battling upstream, and that's what Kim was saying. She mentioned that it's difficult, and I think you do miss out on certain things by not being involved in what is obviously a cultural phenomenon. But obviously, you also get major, major rewards for that. You get to spend more time with other people. You get to spend more time in nature. You know, there are a lot of benefits, but it's not an easy thing to do, and I think a lot of people find that that's an overwhelming idea, so they look for other alternatives. But all kudos to Kim for doing that. I think it's a great idea.
Kim, thanks a lot for that call. Adam, before we go back to our callers, let's talk briefly about how to cut back on this, because you say it's not as easy as just willpower. We need to kind of re-engineer our local habitat to help us make this break.
Yeah, I think willpower is dangerous. If you rely on willpower too much, it'll eventually break, and that's true for everyone across the world. It's a finite resource. You just can't put yourself in temptation's way all the time and expect to always be able to resist. So the better thing to do, instead of trying to resist temptation, is to have as much of the day where temptation is far away. Now, phones are insidious because they actually go with us wherever we go, so we have to make a conscious attempt and a conscious decision to remove ourselves from their presence. And that means maybe saying something like, from 5 to 9 p.m. every day, my phone will be locked in a drawer in a room that I'm not going to for the next few hours. I won't look at screens, no iPhones, no iPads, no TVs. I'll look face-to-face at someone and have a conversation. I'll go outside and enjoy nature. Whatever it is that you like to do, you have to make that conscious decision to distance yourself from the thing that is addicting.
Back to our callers now with Sarkis in Manitowoc. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to call because I do have a public school teacher, and I see, you know, kind of anecdotally, but I see the same type of reactions you might see from an addicted person when we take phones away from students. Mm-hmm. You see a lot of, like, those, you know, sudden mood swings when it's gone, or, you know, inability to focus on other things while it's gone. And, you know, it's a concern with us because as we try to implement more strategies where we're using phones in the classroom, it seems like the more we're contributing to this addictive type behavior.
Sarkis, thanks a lot for the call. A couple things that makes me think of, Adam, you mentioned a phobia. I think it was nomophobia, as in no mobile phone phobia.
Yeah, that's right. It's no mobile phone phobia, which is the idea that you have a phobia to not having your phone nearby. And when you ask people, there was a study done asking thousands of young people the question, what would you prefer, a broken finger or a broken phone? Half of them said, I'd rather have a broken finger because at least when I'm recovering, I have my phone, assuming it's not my index finger, which is critical. So, you know, I think there are about 300 million people in the world who are estimated to have this phobia. And the way you can test whether that's true of you is to imagine something like what was described with the school children. Imagine that you're told you can't have your phone for a week or for a couple of days even. How do you feel about that? Or imagine you leave home one day, you realize you've left your phone at home and you don't have time to retrieve it. People feel incredibly uncomfortable. They have the same responses that people who are addicted to nicotine have when they're flying and they can't smoke for a few hours. So it's I think it's certainly very much like a substance addiction.
And I wanted to get your take on what Sarkis said about schools. You know, we've heard for years, hey, schools, use more technology, harness the power of technology to help teach kids. Sarkis worried, like, well, okay, if we do that, are we adding to this addiction to screens?
Yeah, I mean, here's a really interesting thing, that there's a school in the Bay Area, and the school doesn't use tech. They don't use phones. They don't use iPads, which is unusual in schools today, especially private schools, of which this is one. And 75% of the kids at that school have parents who are in the tech industry, quite senior execs in Silicon Valley. So even the parents, these people who say publicly, we think these devices are miraculous, have decided in all their wisdom as experts not to expose their kids to these devices at school.
Yeah, you mentioned that Steve Jobs didn't let his kids have iPads.
It's incredible. He was asked a year after he introduced the iPad, what do your kids think of the iPad? And he said, they have never used it. We don't allow them to use it at home. We haven't brought it home. Which tells you what experts, the people who know the most about these devices, think about them, that they're effectively quite dangerous to kids in some ways.
Talking to Adam Alter, author of the book Irresistible, talking about addiction to our devices, our screens, our technology. Back to our callers now. Aaron is on the line in River Falls. Aaron, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Aaron?
Well, I was just thinking about this morning on my way to work. I'm behind in school because of my Xbox. I'm tired when I get to work, and it'd be really nice if I could use something other than willpower to limit my access to that.
Aaron, do you have a buddy you could loan your Xbox to that you trust for a while?
Yeah, that's probably the best idea, would be to get rid of it. But, it does serve other purposes than playing video games. You know, my daughter can watch her shows on it and everything. So, but it'd just be nice if these devices had some sort of built-in, I can set this to limit, even for myself.
Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. And Adam, you are actually looking for solutions from the game designers to give us logical, you know, end of chapter points, break points in games that tell us, okay, this is a good time to step away.
Yeah, one of the things that these devices and experiences do is they eradicate stopping rules, which are present in a lot of areas of life. Think about reading a book. Often it's broken into chapters or paragraphs even. You get these signals automatically without even thinking about them that it might be time to take a break. And those have been eradicated. I think the clearest example of this is on a platform like Netflix, where you used to have to make the willed decision to click on the next episode and move on to that episode after one finished. Now what happens is a system called Post Play is activated. As soon as one episode ends, you get a little icon that says the next episode will start automatically in 10, 9, 8, and so on. And a lot of people just sit through that. Suddenly the next episode begins and you think, oh, I may as well just continue. And that's seen a huge rise in binge watching because these companies have removed those stopping rules.
And you write that content developers are taking advantage of that more and more by making those storylines roll to really give you an incentive to take the default and go to the next episode.
Yeah, I mean, they are so savvy. They're very smart about it. And there are certain story writing conventions that they employ. So obviously the last 5 minutes in any long form, say 13-episode season, the last 5 minutes of every episode will have some sort of cliffhanger. And we find open cliffhangers very frustrating. They are very hard for us to just leave open if we know there is an option to close them. And that means we end up watching the last 5 minutes of the episode, and then we'll start watching the next episode to see what the resolution is and then continue on.
Adam, you've been researching this. You've been writing about this. Is there still an element of technology that you feel like has the potential to get you sucked back in like this?
I'm fearful of virtual reality tech. I think it's going to be miraculous, and I'm certainly going to have to try it. But I'm going to need to think very carefully about which apps, which platforms I use on virtual reality tech, just because I think I have the capacity to really struggle with that, because I have in other areas with some games and with email. And so I think that, to me, is going to be a big challenge.
And do you see, you talk to a lot of technology people, is there a desire there for them to make their product less addictive?
Well, it's contrary to the profit motive, which is a little tricky. So some of the companies have people on board with titles like design ethicist who are trying to make sure that any decisions that are made are good for the people who are using the products, for the consumers. Unfortunately, when you have a design ethicist on board, everything they suggest to you is compromising profit. And so I think there may need to be some outside pressure. Perhaps the norms need to change. We need to think of tech a little bit more like we think of, say, nicotine, just as potentially dangerous. And with a little bit of outside pressure, I think these companies might eventually start behaving differently.
We'll leave it there for now. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
That's Adam Alter, Associate Professor of Marketing at New York University. His new book is called Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. You can briefly log into Facebook and let us know your story while you're there. If things have felt a little bit weird today, you're not alone. This weekend was the one, hopefully you caught this, where we sprung forward to make up for falling back in the fall.
And that means we set the clock ahead by an hour and effectively kissed an entire hour of sleep goodbye. In translation, that means if you normally get up at 7 this morning, you still got up at 7, but it felt like 6.
You seem a little irked by this.
I'm a little bitter. I'll be honest with you. Also a little tired today. I'm not a fan of springing ahead. Falling back, that's,
yeah, you get a bonus hour of sleep. Yeah, you get to bank that for later. Yeah, I knew it was coming, and then on the morning of Sunday morning, it caught me by surprise. I looked at my phone time and the microwave time, and they were different. Then I caught on and switched them all. The one thing we didn't catch was the thermostat time. It was a bit chilly this morning as the heat was just coming on as we were waking up instead of, you know, before.
Yeah, and on the weekend it's not so bad, right? Because you can sleep in. You don't have an alarm, but come Monday, that's
up.
When it really kicks you.
No, we have that hour of sleep to look forward to in what? 6-7 months.
Oh, yeah.
So remember,
I can hardly wait.
We'll put a pin on that. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.